This message is from the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. For information, visit wisdomonline.org.
Several months ago, I was sent a copy of a poem that I tucked away in my files. The poet was struck by the fact that on tombstones, you have someone's year of birth and then their year of death separated by that little dash, just that little dash, which represents their entire life. And the poet was struck by that, and it certainly provoked my thinking as well. And she wrote a poem. I edited it a little bit for the sake of time, but it goes like this. I read of a man who stood to speak at the funeral of a friend. He referred to the dates on the tombstone from the beginning to the end. He noted that first came the date of birth. He then spoke of the following date with tears. But he said what mattered most was the dash between those years. For that dash represented all the time his friend had spent on earth. And now those who loved him most knew what that little line was worth. For it mattered not how much he owned, the cars, the house, the cash. What mattered most was how he lived and how he spent his dash. It's an insightful thought, isn't it? I don't think I'll ever look at a tombstone again and see that little dash and not think of all that it mattered and represented. If you'll turn to the book of Ecclesiastes, Solomon has written his own poem about life. He describes in general terms what can happen in the space of that little dash, which represents your life and mine. Now, as you're turning to Ecclesiastes and chapter 3, you're about to be introduced to the world's most famous poem on the subject of time, which represents life. In fact, his introductory line may sound familiar. For everything, there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven. Now, if you're old enough, when you hear those opening lines, you're not thinking about Solomon. You're thinking about Pete Seeger and the birds. Turn, turn, turn is the name of that song. And how unspiritual of you to think that. Wait, I thought of that too. Never mind. Their song actually popularized in pop culture all of this poem except for six words. And it became so well known and went to the top of the charts, and they made an awful lot of money off it, that I found it was interesting that Seeger would later send a portion of his royalties to Israel to acknowledge the fact that their former king was the composer. And this is indeed, as we're looking at this, an inspired poem. Now, before we dive in, let me make a couple of comments to sort of set the thing up. Solomon is obviously focused on the subject of time. The word time is going to appear beyond this opening line 28 different times. This is obviously the main idea of this paragraph or this poem. The poem is composed of 14 pairs of opposites. This is a poetic device called merism. This is where one phrase couples together polar opposites such as birth, death, reaping, sowing, weeping, laughing. And by putting them together in a couplet, it suggests the totality of all that that represents. Birth and death and everything in between. It's a representation of the totality of life. Now, the ultimate goal of Solomon in this poem is not pessimistic. And we've been studying his journal together for several weeks, and we sort of anticipate sort of the cynical, pessimistic attitude toward life. That's not his goal as he records what the Spirit is moving him to record in this poem. In fact, if you go over to verse 11, you might circle that verse. We're not going to get to this paragraph where this verse is located today, but that sort of phrases as a capstone the perspective of Solomon as he writes about these seasons in life. Look what he says in verse 11. He has made everything beautiful in its time. He's made everything beautiful in its time. You could render that word beautiful as fitting or suitable. He's made everything suitable for its time. He fits everything together in a fitting manner. This reminds you of Romans 8:28, where he's working everything out together for good for those who love him. Why? Because the next verse, Romans 8:29, says it will be conformed to the image of his son. It might not suit us. It might not seem suitable. It might not seem fitting, whatever it is you might be going through today. And it certainly might not seem beautiful. But you pull back and you gain this perspective, as Solomon writes, that God is in control. In fact, if you go back to verse 1, he changes his vocabulary just a little bit. He writes that there's time for every matter, notice, under heaven. Now, you've become familiar with his more well-used expression of under the what? Under the sun is a pop quiz. Under the sun, and that's sort of a pessimistic view of life down here. He changes that to in or under heaven. He's going to write in chapter 5 in verse 2 that God reigns in heaven. There's some who believe, and I would agree, that Solomon is sort of letting us know right off the bat that everything that happens in this time-bound universe, everything that happens in your life and mine is happening, is taking place, is being fit together, it's finding its suitability because God is reigning in heaven. He's reigning over all. If I could title this poem, it would be something like this: God has designed your dash. That includes your first breath and your last. And that's Solomon's first couplet. Go back to verse 2, just the first phrase. Every matter under heaven, there's a time and a season for that, a time to be born and a time to die. Those are the bookends of life, right? Your birth certificate, you know that date. You might have a copy of it tucked away in your file. You might celebrate it with cake and enough candles if you got room on top of it. It's getting tougher every year. You celebrate that birth date on that day. If you have girls like I do, you celebrate that day for a month, usually. You're not exactly sure about the other date. He has already determined the length of your dash. It also reminded me of the psalmist, Solomon's dad, who wrote, actually Moses wrote this particular psalm in Psalm 90, that we should number our days. We can't determine the length of the dash, but as best we can, ponder the path of our feet, especially as you get older, think about it, and then present to the Lord, because of that perspective of mortality, a heart of wisdom. Psalm 90. Verse 12, I saw an advertisement on television a couple of weeks ago. They were advertising a personal life clock, a little digital clock, and you can set the date and time in the future. You can set your target date, whether it's retirement or graduation or maybe even a date for as long as you would hope to live. That's what intrigued me because I was thinking of Psalm 90. And you can order this clock and you can set it all up. And so I did for $19.99 because I called right then and called in just in time. I got that digital clock. Very transparent here. This is a season of transparency for me, evidently. Now, some of you know, if you've been around here long enough to know, that I'm fascinated by the thought. I have a vase. It's at my home, and inside that vase, I've numbered the marbles representing each month of the time I have left to live, if God allows me to live to a certain date. And every month, I take a marble out and throw it away. Well, I got to admit to you, since this is the season of transparency, that I've been ignoring that vase for the last couple of years. Those marbles were disappearing way too quickly. Just forget about it. It's sitting on a shelf. I can see it every so often. So a couple of weeks ago, or a week ago when I saw this, I thought, you know, that would be good. I think the accountability would be good. It'd be interesting to have sitting on my desk this little digital clock ticking back. So I got it in the mail. I read the directions, which is a challenge for me. I don't know about you, but I followed the directions. I made all the settings. I selected my target date of how long I'd hope to live. Fixed it all up, did everything they said. Press start, and it started flashing the word error. Error. I didn't know if this was a message from God or what. What are you thinking? You're going to live that long? You might want to know what the day was I put in there. Well, I'm not telling you. But I will tell you, 105 is getting younger and younger all the time. No. Well, Solomon isn't trying to tell us, you know, to have this sense, you know, try to pick a date. In fact, he is just as equally interested, and I want to focus here, on the fact that God is reminding us through this inspired poem of the amazing truth that you didn't even choose the date of your birth. You had nothing to do with it. The first moment you took in that first breath and you let out that first cry for having been rudely interrupted, you didn't have anything to do with deciding that would occur. Your dash began without you deciding. That was the choice of a sovereign Lord who opens the womb. No matter what the indirect means may be, he alone gives life. So think about it. You had nothing to do with that. The fertilization of that egg, which became you, had nothing to do with any decision you ever made. And you're alive right now, Solomon is reinforcing here, by God's determination, God's planning, God's design, you fit into what he's calling beautiful, fitting, suitable. His plan for eternity, he chose to involve you, which means then you're not an accident. You're not a mistake. You're not a medical experiment. You're not some lucky turn of events. You're not some afterthought. You're not an interruption. The fact that you are alive right now is proof that you happen to be part of God's perfect, eternal, breathtaking, beautiful plan. And this is just the beginning. And by the way, let me make one more point about this. You happen to be alive because God chose you to be alive right now. This generation. This time in human history. He decided that. And we bring him glory now in this generation as we trust him, as he fits everything into his grand scheme. Now, between your birth and your death, the length of that little dash, there are a lot of things that are going to take place. There are a lot of experiences. There are a lot of seasons that are going to take place. And Solomon basically layers out in very general terms many of these experiences. And so let me kind of take us through this. You don't need a lot of commentary, and we'll move fairly quickly and make it to the end of the poem, just in time for supper. All right? Notice verse 2. Here's a couplet. A time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. Now, there are seasons for sowing and reaping and everything in between. We learn to cooperate, that farmer does, with God's design. You can fight it all you want, plant tomatoes in February, but it ain't going to work. You cooperate with his seasons and these times. One author suggested that we need to cooperate as well with the seasons of our own lives as God cultivates or weeds or plants, lessons of faith that will later on grow fruit. Verse 3, the first couplet reads, a time to kill and a time to heal. The word for kill is not the typical Hebrew word for murder, which we're forbidden to do, of course. The word Solomon uses might refer to capital punishment or self-defense. Solomon continues in verse 3. There's a time to break down and a time to build up. There's a time when the demolition crew arrives and tears down that old house, and then the construction crew arrives and builds a new one. You're seeing that more and more around our community because land's running out. So somebody will buy an old house and tear it down and build a beautiful new house. There are times in your life where it seems to be deconstruction. There are times in your life when it seems to be construction. This is a season in life. In verse 4, Solomon writes, there's a time to weep and a time to laugh. We'd love those seasons of laughter to outnumber those seasons of weeping. But God is fitting those in. You may be in one or the other today. Solomon simply tells us we're going to experience plenty of both of them. There's a time to cry when tears flow freely. Jesus wept as he bore, as it were, as the infinite God-man, all the sense of the sorrow of death there at Lazarus' tomb. This is the suffering of Job, who we're told his eyes poured out tears unto God, having lost his children and the life he knew. Solomon is expressing here in this couplet nothing less than the legitimacy of both crying and laughing, which means that a wise person doesn't run from either one. Along that same line, the last couplet in verse 4 reads, there's a time to mourn and a time to dance. There's a legitimate time to mourn the loss of a loved one, of the loss of a relationship, the loss of a plan or a dream or a hope. An appropriate loss like that is not time to paint on the little plastic smile. It's time to mourn. Appropriate mourning is not faithless or sinful. According to Solomon, there is then this season where mourning is absolutely the correct, God-designed, suitable, fitting, beautiful response in life. Now, he goes to the opposite. The polar opposite here. According to Solomon, there are seasons of mourning. Notice, there are times to mourn and there are times to dance. He evidently wasn't a Baptist, but at any rate, he thinks there ought to be some times when you can jump up and down, dancing up and down at the news you hear. That's good news, and that's really what you're going to do. This is the wide spectrum of God-given emotion. In verse 5, he writes, there's a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together. During Solomon's day, ancient armies would cover an enemy's field with stones in order to make that field unproductive. 1 Kings 3, there would be times when that farmer would go out and gather stones from the field and use them to build a fence or a watchtower or a barn. And the times can be interestingly applied to that which you cast away and that which you gather. He writes next in verse 5, there's a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. This could be a reference to marital sexual intimacy. Warren Wiersbe, in his little commentary, writes he believes it's a reference to the culture of the Near East, where they would openly embrace and kiss one another on the cheek when they meet, and then they would do the same when they part. He paraphrased this to read, there is a time to say hello and a time to say goodbye. Now, for all of us here, as we're facing these seasons just ahead, like Thanksgiving or Christmas, you might know the joy and pleasure of the season in saying hello to family or friends. And eventually you're going to have to say yet again, goodbye. In verse 6, he says there is a time to seek and a time to lose. The word seek carries the idea of gaining. You could read it, there's a time to gain and a time to lose. Sounds like your dieting plan, especially with Thanksgiving coming around. Here's a good verse. There is a time to gain, amen to that, and a time to lose. I don't know about that. Well, actually, the idea here of gaining and losing, these are financial terms. They're carrying the implication of financial gain and financial loss. Maybe you've experienced the polar opposites of both. Maybe you've experienced a time of gain and loss. Maybe you've seen blessing financially. Maybe you've experienced bankruptcy. Again, God is in control of these seasons, specifically for your life. He has woven into the narrative of your life that little dash, what only He can control. In verse 6, again, there's a time to keep and a time to throw away. You could render this, there's a time to store away things you need, and you might need them later, so store them away. And there's a time to throw things away because you haven't used them in a long time and you probably never will. Very practical terminology. And in practical terms, what I thought of is you could read, you know, there are times to keep and there are times to throw a yard sale. So you people that love the yard sale, here's your theme verse for the rest of your life. Go for it. There are times when you gather, you keep, you store, and there are times when you say, you know what, I don't need it anymore. And I'm going to give it away or sell it. Solomon writes in verse 7, there's a time to tear and a time to sow. If you're familiar with the scriptures, you read often when someone experienced a setback or a tragedy, they would tear their garment, they would tear from the collar downward over their heart to physically express their heart was broken. And there would be then this season of dealing with tragedy and difficulty and pain. One author wisely commends that we ask God for His perspective and for His wisdom as we move through these seasons. He writes, there is a season when it's time to tear, and there's a season when it's time to get out your needle and thread and start sewing things up. Further in verse 7, there's a time to keep silence, and the polar opposite is there's a time to speak. And we would be wise to know the season we're in. Maybe there are times when you should speak up, and there are times when you shouldn't speak up. To understand the principle that when it's not necessary to speak, it is necessary not to speak. I'm reading right now a biography of George Washington called George Washington on Leadership, and John Adams writes that George Washington had the gift of silence. He knew when to speak. My mother would quote to me that famous statement by Abraham Lincoln, I have often regretted my speech, never my silence. She made me memorize that. I have no reason or idea why, but I did memorize it. He writes in verse 8, there is a time to love and a time to hate. Now, we get the part about loving. What's this about hating? What are we supposed to hate? The psalmist wrote, hate evil, you who love the Lord. Psalm 97, verse 10. Solomon wrote in Proverbs 8, verse 13, the fear of the Lord is the hatred of evil. So how much do you hate your sin? What do you feel about your sin? How deeply are you feeling in regret and remorse and in despising sin? In fact, Solomon recorded by the Spirit's inspiring influence this very interesting self-revelation from God that we wouldn't know had he not recorded it. He writes, there are six things that the Lord hates. Seven are an abomination to him. Haughty eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that run to evil, a false witness who breathes out lies, and one who sows division among the brethren. Solomon is essentially reminding us there are things to love and to cling to, and there are things to hate. And we don't marginalize them or try to manage them. Finally, Solomon ends his poem by writing in verse 8, there's a time for war and a time for peace. These were the words that Peter Seeger changed so that you didn't have war, you only had peace. And he redid the last line. But there is a time for war and a time for peace. This is a national response, perhaps, of self-defense or an effort to eliminate tyranny in the world or to act on behalf of another nation for the sake of justice. Human history, frankly, is the biography of war and peace, alternating between war and peace treaties. One author I was reading said that our world is a strange mixture of battlefields and hospitals. And that ain't going to change, by the way. It ain't going to change until Jesus creates a new earth, Peter writes, and a new universe at the end of human history after the final judgment. He creates that eternal state for the redeemed to inhabit forever, and where he, the Prince of Peace, along with his redeemed, will never be distracted, never be hurt, never be engaged in, again, the winds of war. Now, let me attempt to summarize this inspired poem on the subject of time. You've this dash through life. I mean, you've heard of the 100, you know, meter dash or the 200 meter dash or whatever. What about the 20 year dash or the 50 year dash or the 80 year dash or the 105 year dash? What about that? What about the time that God has allotted for us? Well, let me give you at least two principles that Solomon, I think, would have us consider. First, your dash is filled with appointments from God. You don't want to waste them. The Apostle Paul picks up on this idea in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 16, where he says to redeem the time, use the time, invest the time, make use of time for the glory of God. The fact that you have time means that you've been given life, which means you have this gift from God. What are we going to do with it? Use it wisely and well. Jonathan Edwards, the leader of the great spiritual awakening in the 1700s, recorded in his journal at the age of 19, and I quote, I often hear people in old age saying how they would live if they were able to live their lives over again. So, resolved, he writes, that I will live just as I wish I had lived, supposing I live to an old age. That's good for any age, by the way. Your dash is filled with appointments from God. You don't want to waste them. Secondly, your dash is filled with unpredictable events. You can't control everything about them. So that sense of peace as a believer comes from this perspective, that God is reigning and ruling in heaven, fitting together everything that is happening in our world and even in your life to that suitable end, which gives him glory and conforms you into the image of his Son. So peace is not the absence of stress. It is the reality of divine security. Newspapers called it the dance of death. bridge construction. It was a death-defying occupation. I have enjoyed reading and finishing a 400-page history of the building of the Brooklyn Bridge. It's amazing what's all behind it. But this swaying beam that these men would walk across, 300 feet high in the air, and the unpredictability of gusts of wind. In fact, they had a calculated fatality rate whenever they built a bridge. They built into that project an understanding that for every $1 million spent, one life would be lost. Well, in 1932, the engineers designing the Golden Gate Bridge, overseeing that project, believed that those risks needed to be lowered. And so when construction began, they enforced numerous safety measures, like, for instance, the mandatory use of hard hats, prescription-filtered eyeglasses. They even built an on-site hospital for workers who would be injured. But the most effective safety device I read, which was brand new, they'd never tried this before, even though it had been used for decades in the circus, was the use of a trapeze net. They created a gigantic one, draped 60 feet below the bridge, extending 10 feet on either side. It saved countless lives. In fact, the newspapers began running box scores of the men whose lives were saved. One headline read, "Score on the safety net to date, 8 lives saved." After 4 years of construction and $20 million expended, only one worker lost his life. But what they didn't expect was the morale of the construction crew. That net freed them, the author wrote, of paralyzing episodes of fear. They began to be able to focus on their job and work better, knowing that net down there would catch them. I couldn't help but think, what a great analogy to the Christian life. We may not understand the fitting, suitability, much less the beauty of everything that's happening in our lives or in our world, but we join David with this perspective in saying, "I trust you, O Lord, my times are in your hands." Or like Moses, who recorded in Deuteronomy 33, "The eternal God is your refuge, and underneath are the everlasting arms." That's not a cop-out. That's not a crutch. That's not make-believe. That's not fatalism. You know, okay, sera, sera, whatever will be, so whatever, you can't do anything about it. None of that. Solomon's poem is not about fatalism. It's about faith. It isn't about giving up. It's about growing up in our deepening faith and sense of trust in the perfect, wise plan of God who reigns in heaven. This is coming to understand, as Solomon has put it in poetic form here. In fact, if I could summarize it all in only one sentence, it would be this. As you live out your dash through life, God orchestrates everything and holds everything, and he will accomplish everything at just the right time. And with that, I'm out of time. So why don't you go ahead and stand up? Let's thank the Lord. Father, we're grateful that you've collected us here this hour. In fact, being in here with one another was something that you ordained. You wrote into the narrative of our experience and in whatever season of life we're in for us to be here today. There are 1,000 things that you have arranged. Certainly the singing of the music that we did together, the fellowshipping we enjoyed, someone we may have met, and this text that was perfectly suited not for last Lord's Day or next Lord's Day, but for today. And I'm struck, Father, with this perspective in knowing that there are those in our audience who needed this text today. Thank you. We have brothers and sisters experiencing these polar opposites and everything in between. And so we thank you that once again you have led us to recognize that you are reigning in heaven and ruling on earth, and our times are in your hands. And so with confidence and joy, we can run our little dash. And so give us encouragement and strength to do just that. Lord Jesus, we're grateful that you became a man, the God-man. But you had your own dash as a man so that you could redeem all of us who would have been condemned at the end of ours. But because you are the resurrection and the life, you are our Redeemer and Lord, those who place their faith in you, the end of our dash here is the beginning of a wonderful eternity. Thank you that you loved us enough to do that, and you love us even this day.
You've been listening to the teaching ministry of Stephen Davey. This message is copyrighted and may be shared, but not sold or altered. For information or to access more resources, visit wisdomonline.org.